Chapter 2. Terra, the Imperial Palace. Venand sat in the lowest gallery of the great chamber. She had what amounted to a private stall. It had not been built as such. Rather, a large fall of rubble had sectioned this small area of the benches from the other tiers. None of the minor lords who still attended council sessions had attempted to lay claim to it. Many likely did not even know about it. The heaps of tumbled marble and rockcrete shielded it from view of the other tiers. It was easily visible only from below, on the floor of the chamber. If any of the nobility or administratum officials were aware of this corner, they ignored it, preferring not to sit alone, and so Venand had it for herself. She was unseen by the other spectators, and she had a good view of the dais. Around the chamber, the banners of the Imperium hung at half-mast. So did every banner on every spire of the Imperial Palace. Green bands adorned the arms of the High Lords and the spectators. The Council, the Palace, and all of Terra mourned the loss of the last Primarch. Venand knew that for many, it was not a pure form of grief. It was coloured by too much fear. Veritas sat with the Council. Venand was the joint inquisitorial representative, but she was content to be away from the dais today. The truce with Veritas was holding. They had not signed a peace accord, but they had found a way of working together. She could make her voice heard again. More importantly, she could watch the council work through its contortions. Being at one remove from some of the debates was useful. It granted her perspective. She could observe the currents of the struggles, the developing fault lines, the weaknesses and pressure points. All information was useful, she thought. All knowledge was power. In the present crisis, there were limits to what anyone, in the council or outside it, could accomplish. She was determined to push against those limits. She would do what was needed to safeguard the Imperium. Courland, she could see, held fast to the same philosophy. The last Imperial Fist's armour was polished, but bore the marks of the battle on Olinor. The ceramite was cracked from bullet impacts, scarred by blades, scorched by flame. Corlan's face bore the traces of almost as many wounds. His genhanced physiology had healed them, the new flesh roughened and thick. Corlan towered over the High Lords, but it was more than his height that made him the dominant force on the dais. It was more, too, than the fact that he had fought and bled for the Imperium. He was not the only veteran on the dais. Abel Veriolt, the Lord Commander Militant of the Imperial Guard. Lord High Admiral Lansung, Vernor Zek, the Grand Provost Marshal of the Adeptus Arbites, all had their own scars of war. Zek had lost much of his original flesh. Perhaps it was the degree of Corlan's sacrifice. Perhaps it was the scale of his loss, immeasurably beyond the trivialities of corporeal injury. He had lost his chapter. And now, after the almost inconceivable casualties on Ulanor, after the death of the last Primarch, what he had not lost was his inflexibility of purpose and his aura of command. What he announced to the High Lords had the weight of law. They're going to fight you on this one, she thought. They're going to fight very hard indeed.
I don't understand, said Tobris Eckarth, Master of the Administratum. You're talking about a united mission of the Adeptus Astartes? How is that different from what was already attempted on Ulanor?
Venand stifled a cynical chuckle. Courland had barely begun to lay out his vision, and Eckarth was interrupting. Perhaps he was already confused. She didn't think so. He was already anticipating where Courland was going and was impotently trying to stop him from speaking those words. The Space Marine looked at Eckarth, his face stony with contempt.
I have proposed no such thing, Courland said. I am calling for the creation of a new force entirely. We cannot use a blunt weapon against the Orcs. We must strike with precision, swiftly, giving them no chance to mount a defense. Our force will be composed of independent kill teams. The members of each kill team will be determined by the needs of the mission and will be drawn from across the chapters.
Independent to what degree? Zek asked, skeptical.
Completely autonomous with regard to the completion of the mission, answerable to a centralized command.
And whose command would that be?
mine, not the council's.
Wienand was impressed Corlin did not snort in disbelief.
No, he said. That's what I thought, said Zek. This is monstrous, said Mesring.
The ecclesiarch of the Adeptus Ministorum spoke with a trembling voice. The tremor was so pronounced he barely managed to croak. His skin had a bad sheen to it. When he leaned close to other lords, their faces twitched as if they were holding their breath. Before Mesring could speak again, Joskina Tull jumped in.
Exactly, she said. It is monstrous.
The authority of the speaker for the Chartist captains had been in ruins since the disaster of the Proletarian Crusade. Wienand wondered if she saw an equivalence in Ulanor and a chance to regain ground at Corlin's expense.
Monstrous, Corlin repeated.
You are using this crisis for the political gain of the Adeptus Astartes, Tull said. We have not forgotten why the legions were broken up into the smaller chapters, and now you would bring together all the Adeptus Astartes under a single authority answerable only to you.
Corlin's eyes narrowed.
You are willfully misunderstanding me, he said.
He spoke calmly, but Wienand could hear the rumble of anger in his deep voice.
The force will consist exclusively of mission-specific kill teams. These are not armies. They will be engaging the orcs in great fields of battle. This is the strategy that has failed us. We must think otherwise and wage a new kind of war or face annihilation.
Of course you are not proposing unification, Lansung said. You know the council would never accept it. Furthermore, the casualties on Ulanor were too great to permit a mass assembly. You are being disingenuous. We can see where this path leads. Once these teams are formed, there will be nothing provisional about them. Consolidation will follow.
Vangarich snorted.
You're taking a lot for granted, he said. So the Blood Angels and the Ultramarines will happily consent to submit to the authority of the lone Imperial Fist?
Lansung waved the objection away.
If the plan is moving ahead, then the internal politics have been resolved.
This is a coup, Eckhart shouted. It will not succeed. We will not allow it. Monstrous!
Mesring had not moved on from his initial judgment. The ecclesiarch stood up from his seat, quivering, shaking his head back and forth like a wounded animal.
Monstrous! Monstrous!
Why?
Vangarich asked. Mesring snapped his mouth shut. Still quivering, he looked at Vangarich with wide, nearly maddened eyes. He stared at the Grand Master of the Officio Assassinorum for several long seconds. Then he said,
It cannot work. It will never work. It is against the divine will. It must never be attempted. It is unholy. Unholy.
He paused. He looked up at the dome of the chamber.
Unholy,
he said again, more quietly, more to himself than to Vangarich. Wienand leaned forward, watching Mesring carefully. There was something wrong with him. She couldn't tell if the shaking was due to mental paroxysm or physical debilitation. Perhaps both. There had been fear in the look he had given Vangarich, yet his need to speak his truth had won out. Only his truth sounded odd. The other High Lords articulated their fears, and Wienand thought they were wrong. How they imagined the Dark Angels and the Space Wolves surrendering their independence was beyond her, but she could understand the logic of their anxieties. From her vantage point, just far enough away to see the entire council at a glance, she could picture the High Lords as game pieces on a regicide board, the moves of one blocking and shaping the moves of the others, the ones with the least current power feeling they were the most vulnerable, and so making the most aggressive attacks. Mesring, though, was puzzling. She should have been able to place him easily. He should, in this context, have been one of the more quiet members of the council. The ecclesiarchy had little to say when it came to strategy. As long as the orcs were defeated, its power was unlikely to be diminished. Its only true fear should be the triumph of the greenskins. So why was he frightened, she wondered. What possible threat would the kill teams be to him? Why, she wondered. No, she corrected herself. She was asking the wrong question. It was assuming Mesring was acting out of the same self-preserving territorial motives as the other High Lords. The assumption was wrong. Mesring's dismay at Corlan's plan was genuine. Venant saw true religious horror in his reaction. He believed in what he was saying. How could this possibly be against the Emperor's will? That was the question to ask. It had no answer. The other High Lords were wrong-footed by Mesring's reaction too. They did not appear to know how to respond. Even Tull was thrown off. She had tried to build on his horror from a political perspective. She clearly did not know how to do so from the perspective of faith. Venant wasn't sure of the depth of Tull's piety, but it didn't matter. Whatever theological turn Mesring had taken, no one else present could follow him. Abdullius Anwar ignored the Ecclesiarch completely. The master of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica spoke as calmly as Courland. His voice was a barely audible sibilance, insinuating rather than commanding. It wrapped itself around Venan's will and tried to make itself one with her consciousness. She was used to being on her guard in the presence of Anwar, and she raised mental barriers, consciously pushing away the words of the telepath. She saw the slight shifting of positions on the dais as the other High Lords assumed their own forms of wary readiness.
"I cannot speak to matters of faith," Anwar said. "I will speak to matters of principle. What the Lord Commander of the Imperium proposes is the destabilization of the governance of the Imperium."
Relief washed over the council. Anwar had returned sanity to the debate. The ground was familiar once again. The opposition was clear. One after another, the High Lords railed against Corland. They were unified in their accusations. Venant found the unity significant. They were frightened. They saw his plan as a power play, not a strategy. They attributed their own motives to him. The war, she saw, had taught them nothing. Not all the High Lords spoke. Kubik and Veritas were quiet. The Fabricator General's servo motors clicked. His optics whirred as they turned from one member of the council to another. Most of the time, his attention was on Courland. Veritas was just as intent on the Space Marine. They were listening and evaluating. They did not support his position, but they did not take a stand against it. They were seeing possibilities, Venant thought. So was she. The potential for Corlin's force beyond the immediate need was amorphous.
"Cross-chapter kill teams will have no reason to exist beyond the present crisis," Corland was saying now. "There will be no need for them, and the circumstance that makes their formation possible will cease to hold sway."
"You cannot believe that," Zek said. "If you go ahead with this madness, you will create a precedent. A pretext will always be found to keep the teams in place. That's why this can't happen, even once."
Correct, Venant thought. On this point, the High Lords were right to be worried. If the kill teams were successful, there was no way such a weapon would be put away. If they were successful, she thought. Then what? The great potential refused to come into focus. The Force had to be a reality first. She had to witness what it could do. Then she would know what else it might accomplish, and perhaps how it might be controlled.
"Vote, then," Corlan snapped. "Vote and be damned."
The High Lords voted. Vangarich supported the plan. Kubik and Veritas abstained. The others voted against it. Corlan did not hide his disgust.
"You fools," he said.
"We would be to fall into your trap,"
Eckhart said, smug in victory. Venant waited for Corlan to punch the little man's head from his shoulders. The act would have confirmed the High Lord's worst suspicions, but it would have been warranted. Instead, Corlan strode from the dais.
"What do you plan to do?" Zek called.
Corlan stopped. He faced the council. His stillness became dangerous. Venant was acutely conscious of what he could do to the High Lords if he were not holding himself back.
"I will do what must be done," Corlan said, and as he turned once more to go, he added, "So will you."
"I understand your frustration," Alexis Mandrill said, speaking into the Vox unit on his desk. "I share it. But unless and until Admiral Lansung issues new orders, here we are. The captain of the cruiser Sibota, commanding the blockade of the attack moon, was in his private quarters. He leaned back in his chair and put his feet up on his desk. Another 24-hour cycle had been completed, and it had been another cycle of routine exercises. The endless broadcast of "I am Slaughter" from the moon was unchanging. Mandrill had ordered the transmission blocked from all ships for the sake of morale, instituting an hourly verification that there had been no change in the message. There was none. "The task is dull," he said. "It's still necessary."
"I'm not questioning that," replied Captain Michaela Achor of the frigate Cyzicus. "It's the decisions that have made this necessary I don't understand. Such a large concentration of forces in this vicinity when reinforcements are desperately needed elsewhere."
"You aren't the first to notice this, Captain."
"You don't say."
Ochoa had 2 decades more experience in the field than Mandrill, but her family was a far more minor noble house than his. They had served together in the Navy long enough that they acknowledged the political realities of the differences in their advancement with amused cynicism. Ochoa took the liberty of being as insubordinate as she pleased with Mandrill in private. He accepted this liberty as her due. "I do say," he answered.
"You have family connections to Lansung," Achoa began.
"Stop." Mandrill held up his hand as if Achoa could see him. "No, no. There's no point, and I'm not using what capital I might hypothetically have to push for something that will go nowhere at best and result in embarrassment at worst."
"Yours?"
"That I could survive. I mean the Lord High Admiral's. Do you think it's by his choice that we don't destroy that Xenos hulk? The Mechanicus wants it. If the Lord High Admiral has not ordered us to destroy it, it's because he can't. I'm not going to put him in the position of having to admit that. I like my command. If it were possible to send us elsewhere, he would have done so."
"Really?"
Ochoa did not sound convinced. "Really?" Mandrill did his best to be emphatic. In truth, he wasn't sure. The Imperial Navy's dispositions had been erring on the side of caution since the start of the war.
"So keeping a massive fleet presence in the vicinity of Terra, where it is unlikely to suffer any losses, has nothing to do with shoring up his position on the Council?"
"No, Captain. You will cease this line of questioning." Their Vox communication was encrypted, but Mandrill did not trust it that much. Ochoa snorted.
"My apologies," she said dryly.
"We'll see all the combat we could hope for," Mandrill said.
He was telling the truth, though he suspected Ochoa would interpret his words differently than how he thought of them. He was not displeased to be assigned to a pointless blockade. The Sibota had been on no more than the edges of the engagements with the Orcs, and that had been enough. He did not think he was a coward. He simply did not see the value in plunging into battles where the only likely outcome was annihilation. Let the Adeptus Astartes take the lead in suicidal missions. That was their strength. Let the Imperial Navy consolidate gains and hold reclaimed systems. There was no dishonor in that service. He couldn't dispute Ochoa's contention that resources were misallocated. He had also seen enough campaigns to know there was nothing new there. If poor deployment decisions were to continue, he would prefer them to work in his favor.
"So we're here indefinitely," Ochoa said. "How are we?"
She stopped.
"What was that?"
"What did you?"
Mandrill began. Then he heard and felt something that began as a deep, rattling vibration. It ran through the deck and wall of the Sibota. The data slates on his desk drummed against the surface. The vibration ran up through the frame of his chair and through his spine. It grew stronger. A sweeping vertigo shook him, and he almost slid to the ground. He switched on the Vox to the bridge channel.
"What is happening?"
he bellowed. He couldn't hear his own voice. The rattle had built to a piercing metallic scream. The entire ship howled in agony. Blood burst from Mandrill's nose and ears. The vertigo grew worse. He clutched the desk, disoriented as his sense of up and down spiraled. He forced himself upright and staggered towards the door of his quarters, weaving with every step. As he reached the door, A colossal boom cut through the Sabota's shriek. The sound was so vast it sucked the air from his lungs. He fell to his knees. The deck heaved. He dragged himself forward, clutched at the doorway, and hauled himself up. He stumbled into the corridor. The echoes of the boom faded, swallowed by the grinding scream of metal and the thunder of cracking stone. The walls, decks, and ceiling of the corridor buckled. Pulverized marble filled the air. Mandrel coughed, inhaling dust and smoke. The lumen orbs flickered off and on. Ruptured conduits spewed steam and flame. He made his way forward, unable to see more than a few meters ahead. He saw the shapes of crew moving through the haze, trying to run. They flailed as the deck rose and fell like an ocean in storm. The agony of the vessel was deafening. Mandrel could hear no voices or warning klaxons. The silhouettes of his crew were pantomimes of crisis. The weight was sudden, terrible, crushing. It came upon Mandrel like the fall of a huge wave. It smashed him to the deck, his ribs cracked, his nose and teeth shattered. He was immovable, held fast to the deck by his own impossible mass. Struggling against the prison of gravity, he raised his head just enough to look ahead. He could do no more, but even this victory was enough. It meant he saw what happened next. The scream of a Sabota was transcendent. The cracking was the sound of a world coming apart. Power failed. The lumen orbs flickered out. The corridor went dark, lit only by the flicker of spreading flame. Then, summoned by the cracking and the grinding, a new light burst into brief, monstrous life. Mandrel stared into a blinding flare of fire and energy discharges. And then there was the wind, blowing past him with a hurricane's roar. And then there was the cold. Wind and cold. Because the Sabota tore in half. Mandrel stared in wonder and horror. He had that much time. His final breath was long enough for him to see the foresection of the cruiser fall away from the aft. He saw all the exposed decks of his vessel. He saw plasma explode along the edges of the wound. He saw thousands of crew and troops float off into the void, tiny figures, insignificant, a tumbling swarm. He saw the dark of the void snuff out the flames, but the light did not die at once. The void shields went first, their end a chain reaction of brilliant ferocity, the ship's defenses exploding outward, failing after the hull itself. The Sabota was a broken bone, its two halves slowly turning away from each other. The vision was immense. Mandrel witnessed a death so great, his own end was meaningless. The seconds that remained to him were consumed with bleak wonder. Then the wind ceased, and there was only the dark and the merciless, terminal cold. Ochoa reached the command gallery above the bridge in time to see the Sabota break in two. The Orc gravity weapon had lashed out from the attack moon, a single whip of unfurled, impossible force. It had seized the cruiser, and its grip was doom. The beam had sideswiped the Cyzicus. The blow had been nothing, the mere wake of a passing force. It had still been enough to disrupt the frigate's artificial gravity, hurling Ochoa back and forth against corridor walls as she ran for the bridge. Klaxons still wailed, and the screens next to the Oculus were filled with a red script of damage reports. "All batteries," Ochoa said. She got no further before there was another bright flash in the upper left quadrant of the Oculus. The entire superstructure of the destroyer Iron Castellan vanished in the killing light. The ship began a slow roll out of formation. What looked like a small mountain had materialized in the vessel's core. Its rocky peaks projected out of the stern and the upper portions of the hull. Ochoa stared for several seconds at the impossible vision. Just before the greater flash came, consuming the vessel entirely, she understood. Teleportation, she thought. They teleported a chunk of the attack moon into the Castellan. "Signal all ships," Ochoa shouted to Gliese, the officer of the Vox. "Open fire on the moon with all batteries, all torpedoes. Destroy it." Gliese turned to look up at her.
"We have orders to..."
damn Lansung and damn the Mechanicus. If those fleshless cultists wanted the greenskin toys, they could put them back together again.
You have new orders from me. The responsibility is mine. Now do as I say or I'll shoot you where you stand.
Gliese saluted and opened a channel.
All vessels open fire, Ochoa said. Full batteries, full torpedo launches. Destroy that moon.
By whose authority?
That was Huff, squawking from the frigate's steadfast contrition.
By mine, Ochoa told him, as most senior surviving captain. Open fire, Huff, or do you want the greenskins to crush your ship?
Huff clicked off. Moments later, Ochoa saw the streams of shells and torpedoes streak from the blockade towards the attack moon. Imperial ordnance cut through the dark of the void. No one else questioned the order. The other captains had probably already been issuing their commands. They knew what was at stake. The barrage was immense. It was also too late. Before the first torpedo struck the surface of the moon, its terrible maw began to open once more. The shouting, raging corpse had come back to life. From its interior came a swarm of orc ships. Interceptors, fighters, bombers, and torpedo ships raced for the blockade. Dozens were caught by the oncoming artillery. The near space of the attack moon became a fiery nimbus of superheated plasma and disintegrating metal. Hundreds more greenskin vessels shot through the curtain of destruction. Ochoa stared at the oculus, at the oncoming storm of predators. Almost unconsciously, her hand moved to the tacticarium table at her side. She tapped the command vox unit, tuning to the huge band of frequencies broadcasting the roar of the beast. She had no wish to hear it, yet the need to face the full truth of the moment was too strong. She had never turned from battle. She had always sought the full measure of duty. But there was more that directed her actions at that moment. The gaping maw of the orc base transformed the inanimate into a living skull. The face had a monstrous pull. Its power was absolute. Ochoa felt her insignificance before the presence of the active, murderous, sublime. Behold me, that gaping visage commanded. You bow before a god of stillness. I am a god of speed and violence. I am present. I am ascendant. She turned the vox on to hear the actual voice, to blot out the words the sight of the moon tried to insinuate into her soul. Ochoa vowed to herself she would fight the reality of the threat, and her spirit was the equal to its false divinity.
I am slaughter, boomed through the command gallery. I am slaughter.
It seemed the moon itself was shouting in the bridge.
I am slaughter.
And slaughter came from the moon, scything into the blockade fleet. Hundreds of ships descended on the frigates and destroyers. The Imperial cannons shifted from attack to defense. Every ship visible in the oculus flashed bright with straining void shields and the dissipating fireballs of destroyed orc craft. The attackers perished in droves, but more and more and more engaged from the maw, an endless curse from the god of violence.
I am slaughter! I am slaughter! I am slaughter!
The word became truth, and the truth burned the fleet. Corland walked the edge of the dais in the great chamber. He would not take his seat. He would not even stand by it. He would not associate himself with the High Lords. He understood that the realities of his position made the division he wished to enact a false one. He was part of the political machine of Terra now, whether he chose to admit it or not. It would be close to a lie to say he accepted these facts. It was enough to say he knew them to be true. Today, he had to distance himself as much as he could from the rest of the High Lords. He was too disgusted to count himself of their number. If he sat in that chair, he might even derive the wrong kind of satisfaction from the inevitable turn the debate would take. He detested that temptation. It soiled, it corrupted. If Corland gave into it, he would truly be able to count himself a High Lord. The thought was revolting. He saw the sharp features and steel-grey hair of Venand in her tear seat. Once again, she had decided to put some physical distance between herself and the other lords. Vangorich and Veritas were in their seats. Corland half wondered how they tolerated their positions. Whatever else he might say of Veritas, the Inquisitor was a faithful servant of the Ordos and of the Imperium. Corland had no doubt he always acted from a foundation of firm belief. Perhaps Veritas's convictions were his form of armor. His need to pull the levers of power as he saw fit kept him in the political game. And Vangorich was the hunter on the political fields. He was where he needed to be. Corland was not, at least not yet. If the High Lords would cease their posturing and accept what they all knew they had to accept, he could get on with his real duty, directing the blade that would decapitate the orcs. But the posturing must happen. Its inevitability was as certain as daylight wall.
"How can they be back?" Eckarth was saying. "How can the orcs be back? The moon was dead."
He pointed a trembling finger at Corland.
"You said it was dead."
"Of course I did," Corland might have said. "That's why I demanded a blockade to be maintained." He said nothing. Arguing with a little man would be a form of defeat. It would be descending to the level where nonsense was seriously debated.
"Teleportation,"
Kubik said, more to himself than to Eckarth. He nodded his head, in satisfied agreement with his own deduction.
"Confirmed by reports of the destruction of the Iron Castellan. The Veridi Giganticus must have employed their teleportation technology to repopulate their attack base. The infiltration capabilities are impressive. So much more to learn."
He abandoned all pretense of speaking to the Council and began to dictate into a recording unit built into one of his arms.
"Effective range remains the question. Based on present knowledge, it appears to be effectively unlimited. Without any indication of the origins of teleported bodies, we are forced to the most extreme hypotheses in the interests of strategic extrapolations."
His flat, machinic tones managed somehow to sound regretful. He switched into the whistles and screeches of binary.
"Can your team stop this?"
Lansung asked Corland. His fleet was bleeding and dying. Already a third of the vessels surrounding the moon had been destroyed. Lansung sounded desperate.
"They will," said Corland.
"How do you know?" Eckarth shouted. "This has never been done before. You have nothing to go on."
Corland stopped pacing. This time he would speak. He turned slowly to face Eckarth.
"They are Adeptus Astartes," he said. "I have that to go on. I need no more."
"But,"
Eckarth began. He trailed off and looked away from Corland's glare. Corland faced Lansung.
"How long can the blockade hold?"
he asked.
"Not long."
"I noticed you have pulled the Autocephalax Eternal back to orbit around Terra, and that you are not sending reinforcements."
"We can't. If the orcs break through..."
"When, you mean?"
Vangorich corrected.
"The defense of Terra is paramount," Lansung said.
"Of course," Corland said.
What the Lord High Admiral said was true. It was also convenient. Lansung's reluctance to commit the flagship Autocephalax Eternal to combat had moved far beyond the Craven into a realm so contemptible it did not have a name.
"The kill teams must act quickly," Lansung said.
"They will," Corland said.
Mesring had been staring into the middle distance, distracted by inner visions Corland couldn't guess at. Now the Ecclesiarch started in his seat.
"We have not voted," he said. "Nothing has changed. What was monstrous before is just as monstrous now."
Silence from the other High Lords greeted Mesring's outburst. He looked from one to another, pleading for support that had evaporated. Zek sighed.
"What assurances do we have this will not be your coup?"
Vangorich laughed.
"And would you believe those assurances if you had them? Would they mean anything coming from any of you?"
Zek said,
You find our circumstances amusing?
Hardly,
said Vangorich, suddenly cold.
Your responses to them, though, are quite another matter.
Only one response interests me, Colin said.
Even there he was stretching a point. He had little interest in anything the council might say or do. He was here out of brute necessity and for no other reason.
You know what you have to do. Vote or be damned.
You knew,
Eckhart said, sullen with revelation.
You knew the orcs would come back. You arranged this crisis. Now we have no choice but to embrace your rule as our salvation.
Shut up, Tobias,
said Tull. She sounded just as sullen, but where Eckhart was slipping into outright paranoia and speaking from genuine fear, in Tull's voice, Corland heard suspicion shaped by frustrated ambition.
Let's get this over with.
No!
Mesring shouted.
We must not let this pass. It is blasphemous.
For the first time in the proceedings, Veritas spoke.
How?
He asked. Mesring hesitated.
It is blasphemous,
he said again. He looked away from the Inquisitor. He shrank against the back of his seat, staring at the floor. Corland frowned. Mesring's objections bothered him more than Eckhart's. The form they took made no sense. Corland did not understand what was behind them, and that worried him. The High Lords voted. Mesring was the only one opposed. Even Eckhart, seeing himself isolated, joined with the others in voting with Vangorich. Veritas and Kubik abstained again. They seemed, Corland thought, to have deliberately moved themselves to the sidelines. They were observers of an event whose end result could not be affected by their participation, and so they chose to guard their neutrality. They would bear watching. The power games of the High Lords never ceased, and it was the Silent Ones who were most formidable. They were the ones who, if they had not already seized an advantage, saw the potential of one within their grasp. The Council feared Corlin's long-term plans. He wondered how the consequences of what he was about to set in motion would serve Kubik and Veritas. Like the Council, he had no choice. Corlin left the dais without a word.